Reading from the Yoga Sutras, Chapter 1, Text 19. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Rama Pratyabhyasa Purva Samskara Shanonya. The other samadhi, a sampragyata samadhi, is preceded by cultivating the idea of terminating all thoughts. In this state, only latent impressions remain. Om Jnana Timarandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Taksurumilatam Yena Tasmai Si Gurave Namaha Nana Shastra Vichara Naika Nipano Sadharma Samstapako Lokanam Hitakarino Tribhuvane Manyao Sharanya Karo Pancha Kopa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindhu Bhaye Vicha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivasade Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from Newburgh, New York, or near there. This weekend we had our Memorial Day festival. Probably some of you were on the Sunday Sangha, and I explained it, but it was quite I have a standard of how these things should be organized, and I think quite a high standard, and I was really quite pleased. It went very smooth. I guess the nice festivals have a sense of catharsis in the sense that it creates the mood of devotion that's communicated through all the activities. People who come to the festival share that sentiment. They feel a certain unity, which is very uplifting and transcendental. But I really had that sense that everyone was experiencing really basically the same thing, which is kind of a flow of devotion that came from the kirtan and the service that was done. And all the presentations that were made, of course, the kirtans, Karnamrita, in one sense, her kirtans are really unparalleled. I mean, she's so talented and devotional and very wonderful, and the different discussions and talks that we give were also quite enlightening. So I'm kind of here now based, just on a personal note, you know, for the last 3 months between going back to India and Moscow and going to Florida and Washington, D.C. and other things, I've kind of been constantly on the move, and I'm kind of looking forward now to spending more time in one place at a time, focusing on the studies. And in that regard, I think I probably could start sending out summaries and the translations of the Yoga Sutras, which I've just been really too busy to do. So just to bring everyone up to date here. We're only after quite a considerable time. We haven't covered many verses. that's not surprising because we're dealing with sutras. And as explained before, the rule of sutras basically, I think, is something like six words. This one has six words, where the tradition of a particular darshan of philosophy is codified. So each verse is deeply packed with philosophical meaning, which is unpacked by the tradition of commentators. So it's not surprising we haven't covered that much. And basically, we've just finished, I think in verse 17, we just finished through verse 17, the definition of yoga, which is to control the mind by stopping the fluctuations of thought. And we discussed the dynamic of that, the concept of samskaras that our experience is create a certain attachment or aversion to the experiences we face, which creates mental imprints that are always seeking to be either filled or not filled with the object that caused those experiences. And we discussed how the mind, which is in its pure state like a mirror and reflects the nature of the soul, becomes distorted by passion and ignorance and the fluctuations of these thoughts. And therefore, the image that the soul perceives through the instrument of the mind, which is the instrument that the soul embodied in prakriti or matter, sees the world through. When that instrument becomes distorted, then the perception of that soul becomes distorted. And yoga is to stop that, those thoughts, and keep the antakarna, the inner instrument of the mind in its pure condition. And the way to do that is by abhyasa and vairagya, by practice, which means with enthusiasm to fix the mind on one particular object of meditation. And again, the concept is due to all these samskaras, these mental imprints, which are constantly at the slightest agitation seeking to be filled with the impression that caused those imprints in the first place. And there's so many unlimited imprints that the mind is constantly fluctuating. And as the mind fluctuates, then its ability to perfectly reflect the soul and the objects of the world in the proper perspective becomes distorted. So the strategy of yoga is to, at least in the initial state, just practice subduing every thought except one thought, which one is meditating on, with at least a sense of discrimination and understanding of what the purpose of this process is. And dispassion, becoming indifferent to everything else. And this is a very arduous practice, which becomes successful when it's done without interruption and for a long time. And this is the practical point for us also. If we want the real fruit of our meditation, and I'm assuming all people who are attending this sangha are meditators to one degree or another. So the real point is if you want the benefit of meditation, even on the psychosomatic level, just on the mechanical level, if you want the benefit of that meditation, then it has to be done without disruption, and the practice has to continue for a prolonged period of time. And then you get the fruit. And this means that in the morning, the best way to do it, of course, is to take a veil of the early morning hours, which are in the mode of goodness and will facilitate the peacefulness and clarity of mind that's necessary to absorb oneself in meditation. And ideally, one should have the same time and the same place to do it. The concept being is the nature of meditation to focus the mind. The time in which you meditate cannot be conflicted with other activities. Because if it's conflicted with other activities, if it's the time of day where you feel other responsibilities are bearing weight on you, then the nature of the mind is to be drawn outward towards those activities and away from meditation. Therefore, meditation is always recommended that you do it at the same time and same place. And that concept of asana or a seat, a kind of representational of the place that's exclusive to meditation without anything else. So we learned something about this practice and process of meditation. And I know in the morning I try to, when traveling, that's why traveling is difficult. I don't like traveling as a sadhaka, because it's hard to get to see, you have to find your place every day. You're in different places, you have to find your place in meditation. And often your time, because of conflict being set, the more you travel, the less control you have over your environment. Where when you stay in one place, there's a better opportunity to control the environment, which is necessary. Which is necessary. Same time. Same time is very important. Because you have to have the idea in meditation that there is nothing else to be done at this time. As soon as the concept comes in that there's something else to be done at this time, because our nature is fruitive, the fruitive activities will win over. Then the activity that appears to have no particular result at the time and should be done for itself and not for some fruit in one sense. So we discussed this, and now having discussed yoga in general in these preceding verses, now in this 19th verse and the 18th verse, Patanjali turns his attention to samadhi, which is the final goal of yoga, the state of consciousness where all thought has been stilled. And he divides it in two verses, into two levels of samadhi, sampragata and asampragata. Sampragata is where you still all thoughts, but to still all thoughts, you do that through the support of the mind. And the asampragata samadhi, which is discussed in this verse as the other samadhi, is the level where the idea of terminating all thoughts and even the instrument of the material mind itself. That's what we'll discuss in today's verse, but let's go over the Sampragata Samadhi first, where it described four different levels. And even these translations, they're very... it's very hard to translate these words, these stages of this because in Sampragyata Samadhi, there's a progression of subtler and subtler meditations. This one-pointedness goes from the gross to various subtle levels. And commentators described it almost when you try to represent a country by a map, you know, the map is just representational. But unless you're there, you can't exactly know what it is. So it is Sampragyata Samadhi. That was 17, excuse me. I think then it was, it is accompanied by absorption with physical awareness, then absorption with subtle awareness, then absorption with bliss, then absorption with the sense of I-ness. I'm not going to so much go into those subtleties, only to say that I'll try to give some idea what that means. For example, one person described the yoga transfers awareness. Again, in the Sampragyata Samadhi, you've attained the state where you can stop all thoughts except for the object of your meditation. So it describes, you go subtler and subtler. So the yogi transfers awareness from the objects of the senses, just called that which is to be grasped. And then a more subtle meditation is to the organs of them senses. In other words, from the that which is grasped to the instruments of grasping, you know, to the objects, to the senses themselves. And it's deeper and deeper and deeper. This is so, but it still has, the meditation still has the support of prakriti or matter, the support of the mind. And, you know, basically it's just that the commentators agree. It's a principle describing refining one's awareness during consecutive stages of meditation to progressively more and more subtle states of cognition in the quest of pure awareness. So this is Sampragyata Samadhi. And this is according to, of course, the yoga school. Now, now here's the next stage. And this is by the Sampragyata Asampragyata. Sampragyata means that the mind is involved in various ways, and Asampragyata, which in yoga is the higher stage of meditation, is beyond the mind. So therefore, it says the other samadhi, anya. The word Asampragyata Samadhi, which is the higher state of yoga, is not actually mentioned in the Yoga Sutras. Only the word Anya is mentioned, the other samadhi, and perhaps Patanjali is doing this to indicate that because it's the mind is not involved in any way, it's indicating a state which transcends all descriptive categories. So he just says Anya. And it's preceded by cultivating the idea of terminating all thoughts. So this is basically what is the penultimate, the last thought one has. If Sampragyata Samadhi goes to Asampragyata Samadhi, what's the last thought one has? It's just this desire to terminate all thoughts. That becomes one's the only thought left in before one comes to this state. This is the yoga philosophy. In this final and ultimate state, this is the supreme goal of the yogis. The mind is not supported by any thought. And I guess the concept is here, if I can explain it, is You know, the soul is obviously conscious. But when there is no longer any object to be aware of, then the soul can only become self-aware. And that's the final goal of yoga. As this would be called self-realization. As the mind now is empty, there's no... and this is according... This is, again, I have to say it in terms of my own conception. This is yoga thought. I'm not saying this is the absolute reality. There's, although so much, and I think Mahamuni mentioned this, that Ramanujacharya, which is a great Vaishnavacharya, says everything in the yoga philosophy is relevant to us. The disagreement lies on samadhi, or the ultimate goal. And because it's the science of the mind. It's relevant to all, it's applicable to all of the spiritual practices, basically. But the difference is this is the final goal. And in Vaishnavism, the final goal, when the soul is transcending the material mind, the soul still has the ability to be aware of something outside of itself, which is God and one's love for God and one's relationship to God. And one's, in other words, the real thing is, what is the ultimate state of the soul and what's the ultimate state of God? In Vaishnavism, the soul has cognition. It has senses. It has pure... And in our meditation in the Hare Krishna mantra, it's described at a certain stage that the chanting goes beyond just the mind. It goes beyond just the lips. But the chanting is a reflection of the pure nature of the soul itself. But I'm confronting the same concept that there's a lot of wonderful conceptions, a lot of knowledge, but they have different conceptions of the goal. I'm reading a very, very interesting book called The Guide to Developing Life's Most Important Skill, Happiness, and it's written by a Buddhist. And... you know, it's very, very lucid and clear. The only thing is the ultimate conception is different. So, anyway, in this yoga, because I'm teaching the Yoga Sutras, awareness of Purusha, it has, the soul no longer has any object what to be aware of for the first time, and therefore can only be self-aware. And this is the goal of yoga. When there are no objects to detain its awareness, then the soul has no alternative to be self-aware. Because awareness cannot be switched on and off. It's the nature of the conscious soul, the self. So the soul's only option is if it's not objective aware, then it'll be subject aware. It'll either be aware of entities or objects other than itself, or it'll be exclusively aware of itself with no reference to any other entity. So this is yoga. And very interesting that it says, it's very now when you get this conception, where this self-awareness, it's very hard to describe it because it has no support of the mind. So it's only self-generated. So how do you describe that? So it just says anya. It just says this other type of samadhi, and then it only can be explained it can't describe it. It can only explain what it's preceded by. And that's preceded by the idea of terminating all thoughts, And in that state, only latent impressions remain in terms of some scars. There's just latent remain. Now, so that's basically what it says. There's an interesting concept here. And this is, I really think that when you discuss this deeply, and when you really discuss this deeply, you understand, wow, how difficult this type of process is. Because even when you achieve this sampragata samadhi, where you stopped all thoughts, but very, very subtle meditation on the even the objects of senses, or even that, the on mantras, the basic material elements, these very, very subtle meditations, and that's what you're thinking of, and you're not aware of anything else. There's still higher and higher stages, and even at that stage, what's going to be described next, you can become lost and not proceed further. So it's really a very, very much mechanically based process, which takes a tremendous material prerequisite to practice and perfect. Because to shut off the world, he's already described previously that preliminary work is there to make the mind lucid, that you can't really just jump into this type of meditation. You can't achieve the result of this type of practice while you're living in the world. The Bhagavad Gita describes where this is done. It's done in a secluded place, where one is completely celibate, because you don't bear the fruits of this process unless there's a high degree of concentration for a long period of time. So he describes now in text 19, and he's going to describe what happens is there are people that get stuck even. That they can they achieve the dissolution of their gross bodies, and they remain in a state of existence devoid of traditional bodily sheaths or layers. In other words, there are the very, very subtle layers, but yet they still haven't achieved perfection, and they can again return. So he says, for others, those who are unembodied, and those who emerge in matter, the state where only subconscious impressions remain is characterized by the notion of becoming. I was trying to figure this out, and basically, if you see if you combine it with the next verse, it seems to a point where one can come to the level where you're identified with and absorbed in extremely subtle dimensions of prakriti for a long period of time, but not eternally. In other words, as you're going through this process of subtler and subtler meditations, you can get stuck, and only when in yoga philosophy, when you come to asampragata, when the material mind is finally dissolved, is that an eternal position. Otherwise, sooner or later, these samskaras, perhaps connected with grosser objects of thoughts cultivated, begin to activate, and then you come back into the world of samsara. So even on the very finest levels of sampragata samadhi, where You're either at a disembodied state, or it says a disembodied state, or you're merged in matter. It means, like, for example, you're just identified with Buddhi, and Buddhi means in yoga philosophy, Buddhi is the most subtle sheath of matter. You're just, you know, merged in that state. It by the notion of becoming means that even at that state where there's still any subtle connection of matter, you know, even from previous experience, things can come and draw you away. And we see that even in the story of Vishramita Muni, who was meditating for 60,000 years. He was submerged in a lake. And for 60,000 years, you can imagine that he was focused very, very subtly at subtle identification with matter. And we see that somehow or other previous samskaras became activated. And he was brought out of his meditation into the world of samsara. But here it says, now, for others, it says, with the state where only subconscious impressions remain is preceded by faith, vigor, memory, samadhi, trance, and discernment. So I think this means that, you know, one can, I think the previous verse I was reading in the commentaries means that either by pious activities or you can be born in a very, very subtle state of existence. Celestial demigods sometimes, there's very subtle beings according to this conception on very, very refined and higher states of existence. But unless they continue a particular practice that's preceded, it says, it's preceded by faith, vigor, memory, samadhi, and discernment, then they can come down. And if I can really explain, so after he explains sampragata and asampragata, then it's a very abstruse verse describing the state where you can get stuck along the way. And now this verse is saying, this is how you don't get stuck, which is others. And this verse is contrasting with the previous verse where you get stuck. And he says, and he describes that the means adopted by real yogis to attain these states, the proper means, they're indicated in this verse. And if these means are adopted, the practitioner will not return to prakriti like the unembodied beings who have real subtle levels of meditation described in the previous verse. So if you adopt these means, so he says first there's shraddha or faith, and faith refers to a real clarity of mind, where you see things clearly, and it really means where you have a belief in the goal of the enterprise. So everything begins with faith. It's a seed. So it says the yogi has to begin with it, because people can perform austerities for all sorts of reasons and achieve different levels, but if it's not based on the faith in the proper goal, they may not achieve the goal. So in previous times, I guess, just by levels of piety or something, people were able to perform great austerities and achieve very, very elevated and subtle levels of material attainment where they're unembodied, they're beyond this gross world, and they're in very, very subtle level. But the real process has to begin into a faith, because any enterprise begins with a faith that'll lead to attainment of a goal. And it's a goal where you see things clearly, and therefore you can understand the kind of endeavor that really you can trust in. So this faith is the faith in the end of the enterprise. Everything depends on faith. Faith is the, in the bhakti process, the faith is the goal in seed form. Because the goal in the bhakti process is prema, pure, unalloyed love that absorbs the consciousness to such a degree that there's nothing else in the consciousness but the object of love and the love itself. So faith is the seed that the experience that, yes, I should serve God, I should love God, and a trust in the sublimity of that, beginning with some type of seed. Or so there has to be some faith. And then it says, then if you have that faith, if you proceed first with a strong type of faith, it'll give rise to the second item, which is vigor or virya, which is an energetic endeavor, which will continue until you reach the goal. And the commentators take this to the pursuit of the eight limbs of yoga, so this faith inspires energetic action. And also virya, vigor is also refers to celibacy, which is an indispensable ingredient in yoga. And then this energetic endeavor, then it leads to the next item, which is smriti, which means an undisturbed mind, or a mind that's always keeping the goal in mind. When you practice spiritual life, the most important thing is to always have the goal in mind. If you don't have the goal in mind, you're not going to get there. You have to constantly refresh the objective, because that's what faith is. Faith is trust in something sublime. So that's the sublime, the goal, has to be kept in mind. And different commentators say that means also to have shastriya, shraddha, or scriptural understanding, which is always revealing what is the goal, very, very clear within his mind. You have faith based on shastra. This is the goal, this is objective. And then from this smriti, then the mind will pass into the last stage of sampragata samadhi, the trance. And as a result of that, you'll achieve the last item, which is pragya, discernment. And it's the ability to see things as they really are. And you'll actually be able to distinguish purusha from any aspect of prakriti. And Vyasa says this is the final act of the mind. And when you accomplish this, the purpose of existence, the purpose of the mind is achieved, and you no longer need to continue to operate on that stage. And then you go beyond and the complete uncoupling of the mind from the purusha now ensues, which called this asampragata samadhi. Just a few things. And then he goes with a few verses. This state is near for those with keen intensity. In other words, Patanjali indicates that the speed at which the goal of yoga is attained depends on one's degree of commitment. The goal will be achieved, but the degree of commitment, the degree of the intensity of the practice, indicates the speed in which you'll attain it. And then there's some other verses of different subtle differentiations of intensity. So good, I finished. Mahamuni, are you there? Is anybody there?
I'm here, Maharaj, in a
Gail, thank you.
State.
Maharaj, can you hear me?
I can.
One second, sorry. Are you still there?
I am. You're a little distant.
Okay. I had just a simple question, Maharaj.
Yeah.
But before that, a really, really quick comment.
Yeah.
Do you remember a portion of the Brihad Bhagavatamrita where Sanatana Goswami talks about yogis who emerged in matter? Okay, so do you think this is that's the kind of thing he's talking about?
I think it probably is, and when you actually see what a real acharya like Sanatana Goswami is, they know all the darshans and philosophy. Yeah. And the Brihad Bhagavatamrita puts them all in place, you know, as Gop Kumar is proceeding to higher and higher levels of existence, there is a particular state which is just like this, where one kind of becomes lost. Yeah.
Well, the simple question was, I mean, so for those of us who are not necessarily Ashtanga yogis, although in our own way we're trying to practice some kind of contemplation, and most of us, what should we take home from this discussion? I mean, aside from just learning about this darshana, which is great, are there certain things that we can take from this, or that you'd advise we take from this?
Well, you know, very frankly, I mean, if you're... first take it from the platform of someone who's on this path, right? The goal is outlined. Right? The guideposts are outlined. You know, you kind of know where you're going. And the goal becomes fixed, because as it mentions, if there's not strong faith in the goal, you're not going to achieve it, or you're going to get lost on the way. And I'll get to the other point. By the way, which is one of the main points of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gop Kumar was proceeding, because he was inspired by this mantra given to him, but because he didn't have sambandha gyan, balanced discriminatory understanding, he kept on becoming lost at different stages, thinking that those stages were the goal. But because he had the mantra of the highest goal, and a sentiment and feeling for that, he never became satisfied. But it indicates, if you don't have a clear direction of the goal, there's so many ways in which you can stop at a particular level or get sidetracked. So here it is. It's telling basically the yogi on this particular path, what is the goal? Now, what I take for here as the relevance to us, besides simple points that the speed of your practice will depend on the intensity of your commitment or something like that. What I got at it is, hey, the impossibility of this, really. Really. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The impossibility of actually someone in our age, in our particular time, right? Even coming close to the preliminary meditations, you know, of this, you know. So, you know, you can say, okay, how relevant is that? But, I mean, that's the way Shastra is. Shastra really wants to direct you in the proper way, you know. And I guess myself as a practitioner of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, studying this other Shastra, which is quite relevant, because this is the path that people seem to be taking up, right? So I think I should know the path in detail. And I guess even for a practitioner, because the path is so prevalent, right, and practically kind of in vogue, right, I guess that... you know, there's a chance that people on the Vaishnava path could kind of get sidetracked in one sense, you know. in trying to pursue something that actually is not consistent with its own text. Like to try to achieve perfection on this path is extremely difficult, as mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, so what I got out of it, because I was thinking about that when I was studying it today, you know, what's the relevance of this? Which is why, in one sense, I mean, I just summarized about five verses, and there's a lot more detail. And my realization was, is this is extremely difficult. And it takes me from the mechanical path to the path of grace, which is bhakti. The path of, rather than trying to ascend to the truth, the path of, you know, cleaning your heart in a way that you become dependent and humble. And your path to perfection becomes not your mechanical ability to climb, but the condition of your heart to long for the grace of God. And therefore, Prabhupada said, I know in one of his purports, I remember, he said that in terms of bhakti, the process is simple, the application is difficult. Here, the process is difficult and the application is difficult. So the process is different. The process is simple. The application. Why is the process simple in bhakti? Because it's a relationship. Like it says, just as one can take bath in the month of Magh, and then one can take the devotional service. So what does it mean, take bath in the month of Magh? It means in India they have the Kumbh Mela, and the water is really cold. But, you know, 30 million people go and bathe on the Mahakumbh Mela, and I went there. And, you know, there's no restriction to taking baths. Anyone can do it. So bhakti is a relationship, and a relationship anyone can do. It's just like a mother. What's the prerequisite for the mother loving her child? There's no material prerequisite. She has to have love. That's the only qualification. There's no material qualification. She just has to have love. So in terms of the path of bhakti, it's an understanding that it's a relationship with God that we have. We just have to do it. Now, why is the application difficult, even though the process is simple? Because it's a qualification of heart. Because to serve, you have to become humble. You have to become dependent. And so even though the process is simple, you may not be able to do it. Like a child may be able to surrender to the father. Very, very simple. He doesn't have much qualification. But if you have ego, even though you have so much qualification, you can't do it. So, you know, I think it's that type of inspiration that I get from this. And I guess I didn't go into all the details of the purport and the you know, I mean, there's so much in these commentaries about this. But, yeah, I guess that's my understanding.
Well, I kind of, thank you very much, Marsh.
Yeah.
I appreciate how, I mean, it seems to me that what you're doing is you're saying there's some things here that we can really learn from, like the seriousness by which we should take our daily practice, the seriousness by which we should try to control our mind and focus in contemplation. But we can do that in a way where we can take it out of one context in a very harmonious way, apply it in a context in our own practice context where the goal may be a little bit different and even the practice is different. Does that make sense? So it's kind of like,
well, not only makes sense, but what's going to happen right now, and I don't think anybody should miss the next class, because the next class is on Ishvara Pranidhan. Because right after this, what he's going to recommend is worship of God. Right after this, he's going to recommend worship of God. Because Patanjali also sees that this is so difficult. And simply by the worship of God, there's a reciprocation that gives you power beyond your own material capabilities. So here, right after this, this is verse 19, 20, 21, 23, as he says, or you can do Ishvara Pranidhan. You can do what I said and just try to focus the mind and mechanically go, or you can use that determination, that mechanical focus of yoga. But if the object of your meditation is God, then you will get some, because there's a relationship with God, so there's reciprocation. Well, if you just meditate on any mundane object, although from a psychosomatic process it could work, that object cannot help you. It's just based on your mind. But if the object becomes God, and your worship and meditation is on God, then that object can help you. How can it help you? Because it's God. And what you're trying to overcome, God is the controller of. And if God becomes pleased with your sincere effort, then God can reach down in a certain form of mercy to help you. But also the fact is because the object of your meditation is attractive, because it's an object of your love, and there's nothing more attractive than an object of your love, you can also achieve a very, very high level of meditation beyond what you can do mechanically, because it's love, and love is pleasurable. And if something is pleasurable, then you can focus your mind on it. So it becomes easy to focus your mind when it's done out of love. And so as you develop that love and that attraction, you have an attraction to the object of your meditation, so the absorption. So even from that standpoint, you add the determination you have to focus, and when that determination to focus develops into a affection to focus, because it's the object of your attraction and love, then you increase your level of absorption to a very high degree. At the same time, I also, what I get out of this also is there's a process of meditation that you can take avail of also to help you focus until you get to that platform of pure, unalloyed love. You can actually, meditation helps you to control the mind. So it's not that, we just start with this effusive energy of devotion. That's our goal. So how do we begin? You begin by focusing the mind, and it takes discrimination, and it takes dispassion, and it takes practice. So, how it works is also helpful to us. Okay, anything else?
That was great, Maharaj. There was something else, but would you like to...
Go ahead.
For next week.
Yeah, it's okay. Well,
I do. I remember when, I think this was when we were in India, 4 or 5 years ago, when we first discovered this Sanatan Goswami connection with these yogis. I also, it seems to me sometimes when we study these things, and I'm interested if this is your experience. Like we study Yoga Sutras, or I study the Nyaya tradition and stuff like that, and we find that. These are texts that predate our own Gaudiya tradition by over 1,000 years. And it's clear that our acharyas studied these things, intimately knew them, and in some way applied them, or, at least they informed their thinking in some way. I think Sri Rupa Goswami uses the word chittavritti in a different way when he's discussing rasa theory, if I remember correctly. And so do you think, does this help your, do you feel like this kind of thing makes you appreciate the nature of our tradition more because you see it in its historical setting? Or I'm just interested in your take on that.
Does it help us appreciate our tradition more? I would say one thing here too. Everyone has different samskaras. They have different attachments. And you're approaching the process of devotional service in different ways. So different people can approach bhakti from different levels. this type of thing may appeal to a certain type of person. After all, the Bhagavatam itself, which is the main text of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, the Bhagavatam itself has such a richness of presentations. For example, it has, you know, it can attract scientists. It has sections called Calculation of Time from the Atom. Now you tell me how that's relevant, you know? But the relevance is that bhakti or devotion and the glories of God can be presented in many, many ways. So I guess I would say that this is not of interest to everyone, you know? There's many people say, you know, how did you come to Krishna consciousness, you know, by the prasad? You know what I'm saying? And people say that, right? I came by the prasad. I like the food, you know? And,
laughing in the background.
What's that?
I'm here at Rustic Yas Mataji's place, and she's laughing in the background if you hear something. Sorry.
Is that how she came, or? I don't know.
I just think she, that's not why she came. But she just, I think she knows a lot of people.
She knows a lot of people who say that. Yeah, I've come by the prasadam. So there's different people. So I think, you know, this is part of God's reality, how the mind works, you know? And even these levels of meditation, even if we say they're not the ultimate goal for us, right? There's a place in the universe where this happens, you know? Where people have this realization and conception. So, you know, there's different ways to strengthen your faith. And therefore, you know, I'm going on with this class, and I can realize by the numbers of people that take it, you know, there's a certain group of people that appeal to it. And I just said, well, should I get something that's more universally appealing? No, this is what I'm doing on Wednesday night, you know. And it's really helping me. I'll tell you, in my presentation of Krishna consciousness, what I'm able to do, you'll see, because you're going to help me with that paper, Yoga Psychology, which is based basically on what I'm studying here. It is effective. I mean, when you actually can tell people this is how the mind works, and this is the practical means in which the mind transforms, right? And then you can show how spiritual practice actually transforms the mind. When you first accept this is how the mind works, this is how spiritual practice transforms the mind, this is how bhakti transforms the mind. You know, it's kind of a basic kind of knowledge that people can accept, and it's within their frame of reference, you know, and it's really effective in communicating that, you know, this tradition of Indian philosophy, you know, is very, very profound, and not only profound, but very, very practical. I can't wait till this paper I'm writing. That's what I'm doing here at the Revolves House. I'm actually writing this paper. And I'm pretty excited about it. And I saw the results when I was in Moscow, you know, and, you know, the kind of intelligent and sincere people that pay money to come to a lecture, to hear knowledge, that come with a certain open-mindedness and frame of reference that enables them to appreciate perhaps philosophy from another culture or tradition. And then working through that frame of reference, how much you can expand people's knowledge. I think it's, I can't stop teaching it because I'm finding it so relevant. I'm also finding it relevant because I'm able now to understand how my mind works for my detriment and for my betterment. I'm able to actually see my mind more clearly. I'm more cognizant of the things that affect my mind and put me into modes that are either conducive or detrimental to devotion and my own path. So I'm getting a lot out of this, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay. Thanks, Mooney.
Thank you, Marish. Appreciate it.
Okay. Gail, are you there?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Gail.
Oh, well, I'll ask you the questions that I'm not so confused that I don't even know how to formulate the question. So I'll leave those out.
Oh, boy. Okay. Maybe the last part of the class was more understandable.
Yeah, actually, my first question is, can you just, like, give this class all over again next week?
I will. Okay.
That would be great if you would do that.
I'll do that, Gail.
Okay. One thing
I mean, I'll summarize it. And that's why I continually go back. I continually go back. I continually go back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing that I can ask is,
yeah.
Hopefully I can ask more than one, but there's the mechanical yoga, the mechanical approach to yoga. If you do that successfully, what will be the result for you? Which I assume mechanical means without any sense of devotion.
Well, you'll here you'll get certain type of self-awareness, but you'll have no object. So I guess there's some type of kind of, it's a liberation of, I guess God is in the picture, but I don't really understand what happens at the end. Only the concept that, how do I put it? I would guess only the concept of you become self-aware.
Well,
Well, it's the soul is conscious, right? It's eternally conscious. So they say if it has no object of consciousness, it just becomes aware of itself. And I guess there's some feeling of eternality, and I don't know what other sentiments are there. But it's different from the conception of Gaudiya Vaishnavism.
Okay, so it's some vague conception of the self.
Yeah, and like, again, it's these are like, it can't even be communicated because there's no support of the mind. And therefore, it just says, it says Anya. There's another samadhi where all thoughts cease. So if there's no instrument, there's nothing to be aware of because it's not through any mind, then you become self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
What that's like, I don't know. I mean, sometimes, I guess, maybe in deep sleep or something, we have awareness, but awareness of nothing else or something.
Can I ask something else, Maharaj?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a little unclear about what it is exactly that enables the mind to be in a reflective, you know, lucid state. Because on the one hand we say, well, if you study the mind by focusing it on just one thing, you know, then that brings it to the mode of goodness.
Yeah.
And then that, you know, when the mind is in the mode of goodness, it becomes reflective and lucid.
Right.
So I'm wondering, is it, what if the mind is in an unsteady state, but unsteady because it's vacillating here and there between thoughts that are in the mode of goodness.
Yeah.
If that's possible, you know. So what would be the result in that?
Well, situation? I mean, if it's vacillating, there's some passion there. So, you know, it's mixed. I mean, the pure goodness. I mean, you know, in our tradition, what we see Narada Muni, that although he got Saksha Darshan of Narayan or God, he couldn't maintain that meditation. And two things. One, there was some material taint. What's the material taint? There was some attachment to it. He wasn't in a pure state. He was detached to goodness. So that's some passion. But I guess here, in the pure state of goodness, There's no vacillation. You're just focused. You're just seeing the soul. You're completely satisfied in that. But in Vaishnavism, there's a spiritual vacillation. But that's on the platform of the soul.
Yeah.
That there's visions and thoughts of the name, form, qualities, and pastimes of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I wonder why vacillation automatically means passion. You know, in other words, why couldn't you just have several thoughts in your mind that are all on a platform of spirit?
Well, in Vaishnavism, you can.
Yeah.
But if you're talking just on the platform of the modes.
Yes.
Just on the platform of the modes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just basically, on the pure conception of things, there'd be a certain non-duality, you know, and the certain non-duality is either everything is God or everything is part of God. So you'd see there'd be a certain satisfaction. There would be no restlessness, you know. And if there's a jumping, there wouldn't be a jumping around. There's not a restlessness. It's just like if someone would see the deity and they would see God and their love would be in their heart, they'll be focused on that, you know. And it's not that they're jumping around. I guess on a spiritual conception, a very high platform, there's some lila, there's some activity, and it's manifesting before one. But one doesn't have the restlessness. You know, the desire for activity and movement is passion. So it's just a different level of conception and meditation. You're relishing the mode itself. So I guess in the pure sense of kind of goodness, you know, you're so focused on things that you're appreciating everything. So there may be some kind of change or looking at other things. But it's certainly not the speed of passion. Hey, you remember James, right?
Yes, yes.
Who had practiced Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, actually he came at the same time as you in the same place as you.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. You remember he found that Buddhism, so they try to control the mind, try to come to the mode of goodness, right? So the movement is real slow, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, what else, Gail?
Oh, okay.
Last one.
When you were using the term disembodied, I wasn't sure if that referred to being disembodied only from the sense of identification with the gross body, and because it seemed like absorbed on the subtle level. You know,
I think it's more an absorption. If you want, Gail, I could read you what it says exactly.
Okay.
You know, take me time to find it, not too long.
Yeah,
I'll read you what the purport says.
Mm.
You know, I'll read you the whole purport.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, those who want to stay and get the ecstasy of this gyan, they can stay, and others will go to bed. But I will share with you. I'll read it to you. I'll just read it to you. I just have to find out where it is.
Wondering too how you could get distracted at such a high level of absorption.
What's that?
I was wondering too how you could get distracted at such a high level of
because there's still latent samskaras. As long as you're in the material sphere, there's latent samskaras until you completely transcend the mind. But here's what it says. I'll just. says, for others who are unembodied and those who are immersed in matter, the state where only subconscious impressions remain is characterized by notion becoming. Vyasa and other commentators understand this abstruse verse as indicating that the state where only latent samskaras, there's something what it means, unembodied, I'll read it. Here's what it says. The commentators hold that these refer to two types of quasi-yogis who do not have gross physical bodies but exist on some other level within Prakriti. Prakriti has been discussed evolves into a number of evolutes, buddhi intelligence, ahankara ego, manas mind, and the tan mantras, subtle elements, and the mahabhut, gross elements and organs of action. None of these levels represent the real self, the purusha. They are all subtle or grosser evolutes from the inanimate matter that covers the purusha in various layers. But just as normal people misidentify the self with the gross physical bodies, there are higher beings, perhaps yogis, who have transcended the grosser levels of self-misidentification, but nonetheless remain stranded at more subtle levels of misidentification. Specifically, the vidhilayas, the unembodied for him, refer to those who identify themselves as either being the senses or the elements, and their minds remain merged in these aspects of prakriti after the demise of their physical bodies. Mm-hmm. Likewise, the prakritaliyas, or those merged in more subtle levels of prakriti, the subtle elements, ego, or intelligence, they remain in these states of pseudo-liberation until their latent samskaras activate once more, at which time they return again to samsara. More specifically, Vyas and Vachaspati Mishra identify the first category of beings mentioned by Patanjali, the Dehas, to be the celestial gods. Shankara specifies the gods referred here to only those gods engaged in the path of yoga, and Vidhi, that these are the higher level gods who do not have gross physical bodies, but bodies made out of buddhi, pure intelligence. But Acharya elaborates that there are different categories of gods who become progressively superior in terms of lifespan, power, sensual facilities, and insight. Some categories of gods are nourished by insight instead of gross food, for example. In the celestial realm called Satyaloka, the gods have surpassed all the realizations that are encompassed in Sampragata Samadhi. The commentator holds the second category mentioned by Patanjali in this verse, those merged in prakriti matter, to refer to the entities who consider themselves to be either unmanifest primordial prakriti or buddhi, the first evolute from prakriti, or the second evolute, hankar, even the tan mantras, five elements. So, in other words, more or less, anyone who does not identify themselves as being the gross body made of the five gross elements, but still identifies themselves as being some other more subtle aspect of prakriti, could be considered prakritaliya, merged in matter. Anyway, it goes on and on and on and on. But I guess you got an idea now, right?
Yeah, it sounds like that, you know, I was on the right track, I think.
You were, Gail. You're always on the right track. Okay. Let me see if there's anybody that's still hung on here. Anybody still out there would like to say hello? Gail, I think we drove everyone else away.
I mean, it was really a really fascinating class. I really wish that I could just hit the rewind button, you know. I mean, I know these things are online or something, but, you know, my computer is too ancient, so I can't really.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, Gail, we drove everyone away.
Well, how do you know it wasn't Mahamuni?
What?
How are you, Kamal Maharaj? It's Karunika here.
Oh, Karunika, thank you. Okay. I knew someone would be listening. Thank you for saving Gail.
Well, it's not nighttime here. It's the middle of the afternoon, you see.
Okay, great. Thank you, Karunika. It's just nice. It's just nice for me to know that, you know, certain people are listening and when and et cetera.
It's wonderfully interesting what you're telling us about. Really, really wonderfully interesting. I'm really getting a lot out of it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Very nice. When's the wedding coming up?
Well, the 20th of June.
20th of June, yeah. I got to, anyway. I wish you were maybe even South America, you know. I mean, I could be like in Christ Church. Gail Krunick is, I think her oldest son is getting married. She has five children. Is that all? You got more. Five, right?
No, I've got
not
five.
All.
That's enough. That's enough.
Is that all?
She has five. And her oldest son traveled with me for a while in America. You know, maybe he was Ariel. I don't know if you met him.
I don't think so.
Yeah, he was with me for a while. But I'm invited to the wedding.
Well, I promise you, Maharaj, once you finally make it down to New Zealand, especially to Christchurch, you will understand why we stay here.
Wow.
I will understand why?
Yes, once you come, you will understand.
You know, I'm that's attracting me, actually, to come. Hey, what is it, 20 hours or something? What? No.
It depends on where you come from.
How far is it from New York?
It's about 12 hours to Los Angeles from here, so another, 5 hours on top of that?
Okay, 15 hours.
Yeah.
You know, even if there was is there a direct flight to Christchurch from New York?
Definitely.
From Christchurch to New York?
I think so. You may have to stop briefly in Los Angeles, but we would just...
That's not a direct flight. I like to get on and get, you know, yeah, get it over. I like this.
I will take it upon myself to inquire, Maharaj.
Ooh. It's the 20th. Okay. Anyway. Hare Krishna, Krunika.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Maybe I can send a video of myself or something. Okay.
Well, Burijan's going to be here, you know. It would be.
Yeah, well, he's only flying from Perth, you know.
Well, I'm sure he'd love to have you stop and in Perth and visit him there, too.
I'm not sure. Okay. Thank you, Krunika. It's good to hear another voice. Thank you. Hare Krishna, everyone. Thank
Hare
you.
Krishna.
Thank you.